Joe presents Pioneers, together with Open Money, financial advice for all.
Please note that this episode of Pioneers was recorded last year.
Hello, I'm John Amici, and welcome to episode 2 of Pioneers, a new podcast from Joe that aims to get inside the minds of some of Britain's brightest and best entrepreneurs. Each week, we'll interview the men and women who've defined their industry, telling the stories behind the headlines of how they got to the top. My guest this week is Anne-Marie Hubi, who started her career as a journalist, first on radio in Belgium and then in England with the Birmingham Post. She went on to work for Médecins Sans Frontières before co-founding with Zareen Karas the UK's first online charity platform, JustGiving, in 1999. After raising more than $3.2 billion, that's billion with a B, for charitable causes, Anne-Marie and Zareen sold the company for £100 million last summer. You have an interesting phrase that you use about your childhood, saying that you were raised by communists. And I'm interested to know what that was like, especially given that one might not necessarily assume running a business to service charity yes. would come from that kind of upbringing. So what was it like growing up?
I mean, I come from very modest means, I would say. So not having any money was quite a theme. Mm-hmm. But I suppose I came to realize that scarcity over the years, because there was a lot of love in my family. It was a bit chaotic. My mum was, throughout her life, suffered from quite a serious mental illness. So did my sister. Mm-hmm. So we had quite complicated sort of an emotional background. But there was a lot of love. And I was very close to my dad, who held the family together. And he was a socialist, you know, and believed that capitalism had, you know, some very bad sort of aspects. But overall, I think that the experience I had of my childhood is sort of having some tough mm-hmm. experiences, but also feeling that, you know, a lot of people around you are there watching out for you and love you. And I wouldn't exchange my family, crazy as it was, mm-hmm. for anything. So I suppose, I mean, it is true. That is completely bizarre that I should have gone into business, because really the things that I was nudged towards, even I was never given any career advice, but I think the expectations were that we do sort of challenging things. My brother became a social worker, and now he still works in Africa in development aid. My dad was, I know, very proud that I wanted to become a journalist, because that was the sort of cultural background we came from. Mm-hmm. And business, in a way, I'd stumbled into.
Okay, so even with that scarcity that you talk about, was there a kind of a history of giving in your family? Is that something that was started at
well,
that point?
Well, giving money, it wasn't much to go around.
I was going to say, it would seem hard to do that.
I suppose I grew up in a town which had a working class which was quite proud. Mm-hmm. It's funny, coming to England, I saw a different class system here. I mean, there are class systems everywhere, but
Absolutely.
England is different.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up within a type of working class that was very proud, that was organized, you know, solidaire, we say in mm-hmm. French, you know, so, you know, if somebody in your community falls on hard times, you get their kids for dinner for uh-huh. weeks, and there's less to eat, but, well, eat more cheap stuff, right?
Yes.
Pasta and ketchup was
uh-huh.
my father's, you know, which I have a soft spot for. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, you know there isn't much to go around, but there's a lot of watching out for other people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely, that's informed me throughout my life. And when I look, even now, I've taken a keen interest in business. I'm passionate about it, but I always look out for businesses that behave well. And I think that business has a responsibility for doing things beyond just money.
Mm-hmm. You said that your father was very proud when you first talked about going into journalism. And you said that you were given an extraordinary break. By whom? And tell us about that.
Well, I ended up presenting a radio show right after university on national radio, which burnt me out, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I did it for a year. And I was spotted by, well, basically one of the sort of leaders of the radio, the equivalent of BBC, much smaller mm-hmm. in Belgium, but was a lecturer at my journalism course. So offered me a job. I took it. And then I realized just how profoundly out of my depth I was. So I lasted about a year and a half. And I thought at that time, actually, I've learned a lot, but I know nothing. Mm-hmm. I know nothing. And I really need to sort of regroup and learn my trade, because I'd gone from college to, in a way, the big time. So one thing I had always wanted to do, which was to work in English. I mean, I speak English now, but I didn't then properly. I had schoolgirl or sort of college girl English, and I decided to start all over again. So mm-hmm. instead of trying to go sideways somewhere in Belgium, I packed my bags. I mean, I didn't stand a chance in a national in England. So I went to Birmingham, started teaching, and I started getting a small gig on the Birmingham Post, who at the time couldn't get people with multiple languages, mm-hmm. and they needed people who could go and interview business leaders in German or French, etc. So I was at the right time in the right place, and I learned very hard way how to write in English. My copy was torn to shreds every day, and mm-hmm. I went to night school, and within a year I was pretty, you know, I could write pretty well. It was a tough year, but it was amazing. I've always had, it's funny, when I talk about my relationship to England, mm-hmm. you know, what I think about England, often my friends say, you're completely sort of, you know, you have rose-tinted glasses, you know, you're completely romantic about it. And it is true, but I keep, particularly in these Brexit times, you know, where emotions are a bit mixed, I remember an England that was incredibly generous. You know, I arrived with literally £100 in my pocket. The landlord gave us, my friend and I, a break on the rent. You know, I was given so many opportunities in this country. And I learned English with a bunch of refugees. So at mm-hmm. night, you know, there was an excellent class where we learned to improve our English. And, you know, it was you were really welcome here.
Yes.
And people took a punt on you. And I've always had an incredible loyalty, you know, to this country about that. Mm-hmm. You know, you can come here. And I think it's still true.
You didn't stay very long in journalism. So perhaps to the disappointment of your father and your family, what was the draw of Médecins Sans Frontières?
It
seems like an odd leap from journalism into that.
Well, a friend called out of the blue and said they're looking for, here in Brussels, I was in Birmingham at the time, Birmingham and London, and they look for someone who can bridge those two cultures. They have a big ambition. Within 10 years, they want to become completely independent of governments. So they need to create a proper fundraising machine, a communications machine. And mm-hmm. they need communications office to begin to federate all these voices into one. And she says, you know, I don't know that many people who know the Belgian and French ways. And with my ridiculous arrogance of youth, I just thought, well, I might apply. Because by that point, I had realized that, you know, even though I could learn English and I could, you know, improve that aspect of myself, I didn't think that journalism really was for me. I realized that it was an incredibly individualistic, quite competitive at an individual level profession. And I longed for teamwork, mm-hmm. you know, to sort of work with others on a common yep. endeavor. And I didn't think that I could ever be a very good journalist. I love writing, I love reading, but I just don't have that extra edge. And I thought, what could I be good at with what I know? Mm-hmm. And I got this incredible job. Turned out that's because people who were wiser than me realized it was a bit of a poison chalice.
So I was going to say, 24 years old, you got this job. Would you have thought, you think, of just giving had you not had this role?
Well, to give credit where credit's due, mm-hmm. I didn't think of just giving. So I met Zareen, who mm-hmm. had this nascent idea.
She had the germ of the idea.
She spotted the opportunity. And the way she phrased it when we met was, look at what's happening to commerce. Look at what's happening to banking, to communications. I mean, we couldn't even conceive of social media, of course, then. You know, but it's very clear that there will be opportunities for technology to level the playing field, to enable smaller organizations to punch above their weight. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, giving is a perfect sector to disrupt, for lack of a better word. I don't particularly like that word, but arguably we did disrupt the world of giving, because there is no fulfillment. When you give, all you need really is a warm feeling back, is the knowledge that your money is well spent.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful. It's a one-way transaction, and the return, well, it's a two-way transaction if you think of the emotion, but we don't have to ship anything. We just need to compel people to give more, and we can do so at scale and save charity charities enormous amounts of money, which I think we did. So she had the idea, but I think I had experience of executing, which was helpful.
So for Zareen, was perhaps her frustration not being able to make giving more transactional, and that's perhaps where your expertise would come in?
The gist of her idea was there must be a way of compelling more people to be generous, because she thought often entrepreneurs have an idea that relates to their own life. She was an ex-lawyer, an ex-city banker who had arguably more than average in terms of money, but very little time. Mm-hmm. And she thought there must be lots of people who have a desire, genuine desire to do more, but they don't have time. They can't choose. Mm-hmm. Nobody also wakes up in the morning burning to give, however lovely one might be.
Yep.
So we need to find ways which are consent-based, ways of nudging and compelling more people to give. And what better way to do that than this internet thing? Mm-hmm. This was 99, which is perfect for personalized communications at a fraction of the cost. I mean, you know, in 99, charities were spending even more than they do now on tons of paper.
Yep.
You know, often it's an opportunity rather than a perfectly, it's hindsight that tells you, oh, we had this vision. Usually at the start, there's a gap in the market and it takes someone smart to spot it.
Yep.
And when I met her, I thought, yeah, this is so true. And it mapped onto a problem that we were having at MSF. So the organization had won the Nobel Peace Prize in 99. Mm-hmm. We were inundated with gifts and interest, but we couldn't monetize our websites. And I thought, that's very straightforward. We're going to plug something in and, you know, make them transactional, receive money from all these well wishers. And the bank was unhelpful. You know, I was searching on the internet for donation widgets. None existed. And then this woman turns up in my office with a brilliant idea. And I thought, wow, this is really cool.
So people always find that the idea that two amazing people come together, an idea germinates and something brilliant comes from it, is kind of the entrepreneur's myth narrative, right? So how was that connection when you first met? Were you...
No, but we did hit it off. We did hit it off. And, you know, I really liked her approach. And, you know, yes, we did hit it off. And we are chalk and cheese. I mean, people often laugh that we couldn't be more different in every conceivable way. But on fundamentals, what's been a joy is that how we want to build a business and how we want to behave, we're really, really aligned. But we often approach problems from completely different angles. And that means that we can triangulate problems and opportunities very differently, but we always end up much in agreement.
Do you think that's perhaps an advantage, though, that cognitive diversity, the fact that you approach things differently?
Completely. I know in the early days we irritated each other. It took a while to really find our groove.
Yep.
Probably I was, and she has reminded me of that, I was much more dogmatic, you know, on a number of things and irritated the hell out of her. But often, you know, maybe I would take a very short-termist point of view about something, saying, well, it's got to work now. And Zareen would often, quite correctly, take a much more strategic view.
Yep.
But, you know, in a sense, you often need these two things
in tension. Yes,
because while the direction of travel is correct, you need someone a little bit pragmatic, possibly not quite the right word, but, you know, to sort of make certain things, however imperfect they are, happen now.
You talked about tension and disagreements and that you had a specific tactic of, what was it, clean slates every day. How did that work? Because in theory...
You really did research this, didn't
you? Oh, yes. Well, we've got to know the right things to ask, right? So the clean slate, I think lots of people know about this, but putting it into practice, the idea that you really do let go of any animus that you might have had yesterday, is actually quite hard to put into practice. How did you guys make it work? Especially in the middle of that crucible of beginning this business.
That's my mental discipline. I'm not necessarily suggesting that it was true of everyone in Just Giving, and Zareen is quite a different person from me. But I've always lived by that mantra, which is, you know, I want to, if I have a disagreement, a conflict, or a bone to pick with someone, I'll do it in the moment. I like to feel that, you know, I've been true, I've been honest. And if we've had a fight, we've had it, and we've come out the other end. And I find that it's... You know, it's like that Milan Kundera, you know, the lightness of being. You can be light if you've sort of dealt with your conflicts. And I think in business, we often, I think it's true with your kids, it's true with your partner. But in business, it's quite freeing because, you know, you bring your best self or you try to bring your best self to every day. And, you know, you don't let resentments and jealousies and difficulties and disagreements and, resentments mostly.
So you can operate a little less encumbered.
Yeah, less load, less cognitive load. Light is the right word for it, you know. And that's always been the way that I operate, also partly from childhood, in a sense. I just needed to, I don't know, forgive my crazy mom or something. You know what I mean? I just needed to say, process all of that and say, okay, right, today's a new day.
Yeah.
That's how I've operated. But in the business, I think it was quite a cultural trait, apparently. You know, it's funny, when you are in something, in the pot, you can't see with from outside in. And people often reflected back to us how candid the organization was. And the culture was quite fluid. I suppose you always build organizations a little bit in your own image.
Yes, in your own image, for sure.
And because I like that. I like, you know, I don't like ceremony. I don't like status. I think best decisions are made when everyone, whether they are the youngster on the help desk or the chairman of the company, can speak freely.
It's a little bit of that childhood socialism
coming
back.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
It clearly worked for you. But in those early days, amongst all that lightness, there must have been doubts.
Professionally,
personally, doubts.
Don't set up something huge.
Set up something tiny that you hope will be huge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think we were probably too early by about 3 years, or certainly two. And so the early days were hard. The crash happened soon after the formation of the company. So we had to regroup. We had funding, but we had to stretch it out a long way. It's hard to remember now how in 2000, the internet itself took a brand knock, you know. If you were an internet company, nobody thought you would get anywhere. And so therefore getting in front of people was heroic, frankly. It was a lot of, you know, hitting the phone, getting in front of people, pitching for something that didn't really exist, just sheer persistence.
So,
and it's
now
hard when people, you know, your friends tell you, why don't you just go and get a proper job?
Yep. When was it the point that you thought we're onto something?
Well, there were several moments. One of them was when the London Marathon agreed to, or the organizers of the London Marathon agreed to recommend this platform to their runners. And you can see why we needed this moment in time where tens of thousands, not quite at first, but a significant number of people embrace this platform, tell their friends about it, because you need that network effect in that moment in time. But we could see a viral effect, for lack of a better word. So that was a very important moment where certainly in the Southeast and then beyond, people became aware of this brand. Cancer Research UK entrusted at Just Giving with the sort of behind-the-scenes running of their Race for Life series. Again, it was an incredible gift to be able to give close to 750,000 women a Just Giving page.
Yep.
So that was a big deal for us. And it changed. It changed the language. I mean, we began to notice jokes on the radio where Just Giving was mentioned, and it was assumed that the audience would know what it was.
So
and
the
you think,
awareness
oh,
was really
you know,
being
awareness
raised.
Is really yes. changing, and people are really taking this product and making it their own. So we saw not just runners using it, but bereaved families, corporates. People really got it. And that's the joy of it. And then after that, you know, it's you deal with a different problem. You know, how do you scale this company? How do we begin to unpack the richness of the data of all these now millions of people doing generous things? How do we make sense of that? So you can begin to attack a sort of higher order of problem.
Yeah. So if London Marathon, if their kind of endorsement and the encouragement of the runners to use you was one of those pivotal moments, what was the experience like when they left? I heard that you even find out about the partnership ending in a less than ideal way.
Well, you know, it was in a sense, so this is 2010 or 11, thereabouts. The London Marathon decided to part ways with us and instead to partner with the Virgin Bank, Virgin Money. And what it meant was we really returned to our... This is where having a strong sense of mission is really important. Mm-hmm. Say, okay, what does growing the world of giving by understanding, by doing a better job of connecting people who care with the causes they love, you know, what does that actually mean? How can we get there faster? You know, at the time, I won't lie, it was a real wake-up call. Mm-hmm. But it was a wake-up call for the company. And I think it was the making of us.
So the loss of the London Marathon, the emergence of this competitor, such as it was, crystallized your thinking and allowed you to really reinvigorate the organization.
Absolutely, yeah. Without a doubt.
But I still want to know, how did you find out? Because this is one of those things, you know, for entrepreneurs, for people who are really trying to strive, they create partnerships that they think are going to be enduring that are actually partnerships. And then suddenly they find out that perhaps it wasn't perceived that way on all sides. So how did you find out that the London Marathon was moving in a different direction?
We found out, like everybody else, through a press release or through the media. You might as well find out.
So there's a benefit to, even if you don't like the way you find out, it's a benefit to finding out.
If you run a business that you really believe in, mm-hmm. and you have paid attention for many years to the welfare of your customers, for lack of a better word, you know, you really have to have that self-belief. Mm-hmm. You know, if you serve people well and you do a great job and people have experienced over a number of years that you are often putting their interests above your own, which mm-hmm. we had done, and I could give other examples where we took commercial decisions that were harmful to the long-term performance of the business, but we thought were the right thing to do for charities. People have long memories, actually. Yep. And of course, some charities, often nudged by their trustees, often charities, to my despair, think that cheap is better. Fine. Some charities chose to switch platforms or to reduce their usage of Just Giving. That's their choice. But those I know, and we could prove that through the overall growth of the business and at an individual charity level, that the charities that were doing well on Just Giving continued to remain committed to it because they knew where their best interests lay.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about not focusing on being the cheapest, but yeah. rather to offer this quality. But one of the things that perhaps is a question that you often get and that people are intrigued by is the idea that you are a business working to further philanthropy.
Yeah.
So how do you square that, do you think, when you talk to people about it who might think that more naturally this should have been a charity in the first place?
There's a deeply held sort of romantic view that if something is socially valuable, mm-hmm. it should be run on a charitable basis. And I think that argument is flawed because in order to do things at scale consistently well, in order to attract the talent to do the two things I've just mentioned, mm-hmm. you actually need an economic engine and you need investment. Even if we had wanted to be a charity, we could not have found the benevolent sponsors mm-hmm. to pay millions of pounds every year to run this business.
So almost to generate the kind of largesse that you wanted to enable people's largesse, you needed the investment, which meant it had to be a business rather than
Yes, maybe I'm saying this in a sort of long-winded way and you might want to cut this out.
Not at all.
But when you look at what it takes to create a platform that's global, mm-hmm. that's super robust, that's smart, you actually need an enormous amount of investment. You need incredible talent because we needed to bring engineers, data scientists, product designers, etc., who could rightfully have gone anywhere else, to Google, to Microsoft, to any number of tech companies in the UK. We needed that talent to make that vision a reality. That costs money.
Yep.
And if you wanted to achieve that level of investment year in, year out, I would question that the charitable model of donations works. Mm-hmm. I think if you can harness risk-based investment, like true investment, commercial, for a social purpose, in time you can return a decent return on investment to those investors, and you can achieve a much bigger social impact. So I think that is the exciting sort of new phase in capitalism, if mm-hmm. I can go grandiose for one moment. I think that there are loads of opportunities around health, education, any number of things. If we're prepared to look at the reality we face in the eye and be less dogmatic about, oh, health should always be run on the NHS lines, et cetera, et cetera. If we are open to new models, which are more hybrid, I think we can achieve much greater social impact on a commercial basis. Mm-hmm. As long as investors are patient and take a long term, it is possible to combine a decent return and a really, really compelling social story. Mm-hmm.
There's real sense to the idea. And certainly when you look at the numbers, we talked about the $5 billion that you've enabled to be raised. But the press, especially in this country, has not always bought what you're selling in terms of that narrative. Can you talk about some of the experiences you've had seeing your brand, your organization represented in the press?
Yeah, we've been, the organization continued to be misunderstood. You know, every mm-hmm. year, the Daily Mail particularly would call and, you know, when we filed our accounts and asked questions. And actually, at first it irritated me and I thought, well, do you know what? It's going to take a while and we'll keep explaining and we'll keep showing in numbers how much we invest. For many, many years, we were loss-making, mm-hmm. proving the point I've just made. So in a sense, I got quite hurt at times, thinking, why can't people get it? And on the other hand, I thought, if that's what it takes, I'll just take a long view. So for many, many years, you know, we were asked this question, how dare you charge? How dare you be a business? And every year we explained once more, this year our investment enabled us to make all these changes for all charities in the UK. We raised many more millions as a result, and we think the third sector is better off.
Yeah.
And I think even the most, you know, negative critics have come to see the numbers speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. People are beginning to realize that we're going to have to be more creative with the way we harness capital.
Yeah. I think one of the things that certainly we saw when we looked at some of the coverage, it was kind of crystallized around people like Stephen Sutton mm-hmm. when he died, the blogger who tried to raise £10,000, mm-hmm. and he ended up raising over 3 million.
That's right.
But just giving in that scenario took a lot of heat because with all that money raised, it didn't waive the fee. Did you expect to get backlash for that? And what was the rationale from your point of view, given that you must have known, I think, that the amount of attention that would be layered on that?
Yes, we did make a very significant donation. Mm-hmm. We've had to stand up and be counted and say we knew Stephen really well. He chose Just Giving because he knew he'd raise more money. He raised, and his family are proud to have raised on this platform more than they ever imagined. Mm-hmm. And that's because the platform is funded by a small fee that enables it to do exactly that. And we explained and we made our contribution and we engaged with our critics.
It must have been really difficult because I know that especially at that time, some of the criticism stopped really being about the business and started being quite personal.
Yes. I think that's, you know, I know enough about the British press to know that things are personal. I mean, a business is not a business. It's a bunch of people. And mm-hmm. at times people have been pretty personal. But I, you know, it's much easier to defend something when you really believe it. Mm-hmm. And I haven't got an ounce of doubt about the value of the business as it is. So we charge a small fee so that we have a sustainable business that for years to come can keep raising the billions that the third sector needs. I think the numbers speak for themselves. There are cheaper platforms. There are even some that are free, mm-hmm. but they are raising a fraction. It's a choice. If you're in the business of changing the world and you're a charity or an activist like Stephen was, you can go and raise small amounts of money and feel good about the fact that it's cost very little. Or you can raise millions and actually leave a massive legacy. Mm-hmm. He did that. He chose Just Giving because he trusted that it would do a much better job than other platforms. And we're really proud to have played a small part in his success. And in the end, we have to charge for that to continue and to be better all the time.
So you talk about the value of the business. Was exit always part of the plan? And how did you approach that?
You know, when you raise investments, mm-hmm. there is a tacit understanding that maybe one day the turn of the investors will come.
They need to see real return.
Yes. And I think, in a sense, we've always talked about the business in very simple terms. It is a business. Some people have compared us or called us a social enterprise when that was in vogue. Mm-hmm. And we never rejected the term, but we liked the honesty of we've been entrusted with not insignificant amounts of risk capital. People mm-hmm. have taken a punt on us. for many years, year in, year out, we've gone back to our board of directors and asked them to not pay any dividends. Even when we were on the odd years, we were profitable, we didn't pay dividends. We always ploughed all of our surpluses back into the business. And we did that till the day we sold the business. And, you know, there came a point 17 years on when the right partnership came along, mm-hmm. which would enable the business to fulfill its mission on a much bigger scale, then that felt like the right home for it.
So you talk about the right partnership coming along, but even when it's the right partnership, the night before you signed the deal, what was your emotion? Was any regrets in that moment?
No, I don't do regrets.
Yeah, you mentioned the clean slate is useful for that. Yeah.
I don't do regrets. I think, I mean, there are lots of things that I was emotional about, but I felt genuinely that once you've built something that has reached a certain stage, you have to be honest about what it would take to take it to the next level. Mm-hmm. And this business, I think, has had an outsized influence on the UK. Pretty much everyone I have met informally, you know, you meet new people all the time, and I have yet to meet someone who doesn't know it. Mm-hmm. And I've been touched by that, and people have been touched by the sort of almost affection that a lot of people, in spite of the Daily Mail, have had for the business. Because almost everyone I knows someone who's been really happy using it and feels proud about what they've done. And I think that's an amazing gift to have been part of that journey. But I also knew, we all knew, that for the business to become truly global, it was global in the sense that it had 165
countries.
And, mm-hmm. you know, or we had donors all over the world. But, you know, it deserves to have an even bigger impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, how could you turn that down?
What did you learn about patience in this process?
I learned a lot about patience.
It's really essential. And the other thing here I think would be interesting to know, lots of different countries have different priorities for giving. What have you learned about Britain's priorities for giving?
Yeah, good question. I know a lot about the differences between the US and the UK, but in the UK, there is a genuine universality about wanting to give. Mm. I mean, it's a deep, deep human trait. But what is, I think, very specific about the UK, which in a way predates the business and enabled the business, it's that here in this country, it's a very social activity. Mm-hmm. So in Belgium, people are quite private about their giving. In Germany, that's the case too. And as a result, they do it through bank accounts, et cetera, et cetera. Here, you know, the London Marathon, the silly costumes and all that are evidence that there's a sort of fun element and there's a community element. And there's also a bit of a selfish element in the best possible meaning of the term. I think that people want to be seen to be doing good things. Mm-hmm. And it's part of being a good person here. And I think that's a very rich territory. Obviously, we built this business on mm-hmm. that very premise. And it's not where we started. We sort of came to that realization and then it became the heart of the business. But in Britain, people just love to mix social glue with charity. Mm-hmm. And that's incredible because it brings people who may not into a sphere, your sphere of influence, who may not necessarily have cared about Stephen Sutton's or, you know, cause or your friend Joe's particular charity. But the fact that they're putting their social reputation on the line compels you to then have a curiosity for that cause.
Yet another way to make a connection to that charity.
Exactly. Yeah. And it changes. Mm. What we've discovered is that it changes the way that people look at the cause itself. So essentially, we've turned millions of people who could have been single individual contributors into advocates, into mm-hmm. nodes in a network that bring more people to view this cause with greater generosity. And that's very powerful.
Mm. So we talked business for an hour, but now I want to know a little bit more about the real Anne-Marie Hubi. We steal this section from James Lipton of Inside the Actor Studio and have some quick-fire pop quiz questions, which don't always go quick-fire, I will tell you, but let's attempt. So what profession, other than your own, would you like to attempt?
Gosh, sculptor.
See, this is supposed to be quick-fire, but sculptor, that's so remarkably tangential.
Very physical.
Which business or company, apart from your own, do you wish you'd founded?
Oh, do you know, I can't off the top of my head.
Who's your hero?
I don't really do heroes.
Really?
No.
It's interesting for someone who you know, you're talking about how you create these nodes of people who are essentially little advocates and heroes.
Oh, influencers, yes, of course. But no, I have a real problem with hero worship.
Okay. What's your favourite word?
Oh, No, it's a
family
program. It
can be any language that you choose. Any language that you choose at all.
Well, I have an expletive, but I, you know.
Yes, we can use that too.
It begins with a B.
You can say it. There are any number of them.
Okay. I love English, and bollocks is my favourite.
Ah, see, that is a surprisingly popular word right
there. Is it?
Oh, yes. What is your least favourite word?
Empower.
Okay. See, I feel like we need another hour to discuss that now. What's your biggest fault?
Control freakery.
Mm-hmm. What's your idea of happiness?
Peace.
What keeps you awake at night?
Domesticity.
Domesticity. I don't know how many people fear of domesticity keeps them awake.
It's not fear. It's my to-do list for the following day.
I've got you. Got you. Oh, the ironing keeps me. I suppose. Yes. All right. Fair enough. I get that.
You have no idea.
Mm-hmm. What's your... this might have already been answered. What's your favourite swear word?
Bollocks.
Bollocks. Good. If heaven exists, what would you like God to say when you arrive?
Oh, wow. That's cute.
Mm-hmm.
That way to the bar.
We would get along just fine then. What next?
Ask me again in 6 months.
Delaying tactic. Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, control freakery and urgency in your life and when it comes to this.
I'm experimenting with a bit of peace.
Is this your patience phase?
Yes, that's right.
Ah, okay. I'll give you that. All right, that's it for Pioneers. My thanks to Anne-Marie Hoopy. Thank you so much. And don't forget, you can download episodes 1 of the show and all of Joe's audio offerings from your usual podcast providers. Leave us a review if you'd be so kind, and we will speak to you next week.
You've been listening to Pioneers, together with Open Money. Manage it, save it, invest it.